Hello and welcome to Late to It. I'm Noma Frisby.
I'm Kirsty Dill.
And this is a podcast about reading books at the right time. Back for season five. Did I say season? I hate that word.
Series we are five. In America now.
Not American. Series five, what have you been up to in the meantime, Kirsty?
Well, not very much. It's been the school holidays, so I have been entertaining children with varying degrees of success. Certainly as the holidays went on, less as we got closer desperately to school going back. I have read some books. I have done a lot of work. I have been to a theme park, as I was just telling them before we started recording. My daughter, who is 10 and a half, is a maniac and was just like, we're going to go on all the big upside down roller coasters. And then after the first one got cold feet. And I was delighted because it meant I didn't have to go on the Smiler with its 14 inversions. Nemesis was enough. But yeah, that's broadly, I wish I could say I've done some magnificent thing over the summer. Like I have cultivated a rose garden and been on some exotic holiday, but I haven't. I've just been sort of just carrying on doing the same as I normally do. What about you?
I did an awful lot of work, most of which I can't talk about, which I like saying because it makes me sound like a spy. I am not a spy. but the thing that I did get into, you'll like this, Kirsty, because I know you like your garden. And obviously, we've talked about the flat. I live in a first floor flat, tongue twister. So I can't have a garden. But about 15 months ago, one of my friends bought me a succulent, right? I hadn't had a plant for years because I can't keep them alive. But I kept this succulent alive for a year. And then I decided in the summer that I was going to get some more plants. So I've now gone from having one plant to 10 plants.
This is how it happens. Yeah. This is how it happens. I cut out a tiny bit of my lawn to make it a tiny flower bed, which had room for about 3 plants. And now it's like the full width of my garden.
Yeah, well, it got to one point and I absolutely loathe people who say they're a whatever mom, but I literally was a plant mom. I was I tell you honestly, but I am so pleased with myself already, because I hadn't realized that begonias are actually quite difficult. I just thought they were dead pretty, right? So I bought a begonia escargot, the snaily like leaf one, and a begonia maculata, which is the one that apparently Christian Louboutin designed the red sole of his shoes because of. It's the polka dot one, okay. Got the red on the back. Anyway, not realising what a nightmare they might be to look after, I have nurtured those bloody begonias, right? And the maculata, I'm not kidding, I have had to do all sorts. I thought it was too hot in the window, so I moved it out the way. Turns out that everything I'd read about overwatering them were nonsense. I weren't watering them enough. I ended up moving it back. All of this palaver. Anyway, I'd read something that said, if it likes what you're doing, it'll flower. And on the day it flowered, I told everybody about it. And I'm so, it's had two flower, well, like two little bunch. I don't know if you've seen them, but they sort of come out in little groups.
Yeah.
So it's flowered twice and I'm very happy. So
congratulations.
Thank you. So now I am both a cooking bowl and a plant bowl. I mean, I'm like, what's next? I'm going to take up or something.
<That's> steady. I have to do boring garden chat coming in. I have to say the hot weather. Oh, that's another thing I've been doing all summer, trying to stay cool. Because let me tell you, the day it hit 41 down here, I was not a happy person. The hot weather has absolutely decimated my garden, and I do live in the Thames Water area. So I've had hose pipe bam and I've been going out with my watering can, but it's not been anything like enough. So most of my garden died.
Oh no.
It's looking very brown out there. So I have to do a bit of cutting back, but happily my hardy fuchsia, and hardy fuchsia, by the way, is my drag name. my hardy fuchsia is coming back a treat. That's honestly, here's my one gardening tip. If you do have outside space and you do want to plant something bright in your garden, a hardy fuchsia, honestly, you cannot kill the bastard. It just keeps coming back. Yeah, I've had mine several years now, and it just keeps going. So, yeah, that's coming back from the dead. But Hollyhock has gone in a bad way. It's been bad times for Hollyhock. Anyway, that's my garden update.
Okay. What about your reading update, Kirsty?
What about my reading update? Well, I'll tell you what I've been reading. It's a very on brand. I've been reading Professor Dame Sue Black's memoir, although she's just Sue Black on the cover, All That Remains, A Life in Death, which was published by Black Swan a couple of years ago, 2018 in paperback. It's really, really, really good. So Sue Black is a forensic anthropologist who has had this long and illustrious career in forensic anthropology, which is slightly different from sort of forensics, as you know, we might see on Silent Witness or whatever. I mean, aside from that's TV, obviously. It's not just about the body, but it's also building this picture of their life, building a picture of a life from someone's remains, essentially, which is really interesting. So she talks, it's a memoir, so she does talk about her own life and how she ended up in that field. And she talks about seeing a dead person for the first time, which was her great uncle, and being asked to go and check he was all right, like in that sort of kind of Scottish, mm-hmm. she's Scottish, like the Scottish way of just checking that he was looking suitable in his coffin and he was all right. And she talks about that through to medical school and working as a medical student on cadavers. And she talks at quite a lot of length about what a gift it is for those people who leave their bodies to medical science, and just how those people are doing something quite extraordinary with that gift. They are entrusting their remains to furthering knowledge. Whole generations of medical students obviously learn their anatomy and learn their profession from the gift of these people. And for her, I mean, I don't know if this is still the case or it's just the case for her university or what, but they worked on her and her partner worked on the same cadaver for the whole duration of the module, kind of thing. So it was one person working on different parts of his body and different parts of his anatomy. And so although they're never told any biographical details, they don't know his name, they don't know anything about him or what his life was, it, you know, they ended up feeling very attached and they gave him a name, and you know, they, you know, she ended up thinking a lot about this man and what he had done and where he was now. And I've heard this before, because actually a friend of mine had a relative who left their body to medical science. The university have this sort of service of thanksgiving, because obviously there's no funeral or anything when, you know, there's no cremation or burial when, you know, someone leaves their body. But they have this service of thanksgiving where the medical students go and thank all the families of the people who gave their bodies to them. So it's sort of a kind of nice closure. And she talks about this, you know, in the Western world, you know, we are so fucked up about death. Like we can't deal with it. We don't want to think about it. We don't look at it. And actually she goes into this really interesting but very respectful detail about what happens to our bodies. And, you know, whether we like it or not is going to happen to our bodies. It will happen to my body and your body and everyone listening to this. And it was quite, at times I felt quite kind of, even as someone who has a morbid fascination with various things, there were a few times I had to sit down and I had to kind of put it down and go, oh, this feels really horrible. But actually it's because we're so weird about death in this society, you know. So there's all of that sort of stuff, but there's also stories from later in her career. So she was part of the forensic team that went out to Kosovo to examine the remains that were found in mass graves as part of war crimes investigations against Milosevic and so on. And then later in 2006, she was the first Briton that went out after the tsunami in the Indian Ocean to start looking at remains and start trying to identify people who had been killed in that. And also kind of on the political side, you know, particularly around the tsunami, she was very critical of the government, the Blair government at that point, for not having a task force, for not sending, you know, they had no intention of sending any Brits out to help with this massive, I mean, it's basically a humanitarian effort to identify and sort of reunite the dead with their people so that they can have that closure, that ritual that, you know, we definitely need. So yeah, it was really, really interesting. There's plenty of squelchy details for those who are interested in such things, and I am. But also there's some really serious kind of philosophical questions about how we confront death and what happens to our bodies, these vehicles that have carried us for our lives, be they long or short, what happens to them and what we want to happen to them, and how we as a society need to get our arses in gear about it, frankly.
She sounds like she's had a really interesting life. Yeah, I don't know if I give a toss what happens to my body after I'm dead. I'll be honest. But I do think it's interesting. So I'm just like, this week, we're recording this as the Queen's Lying in State, but more importantly to me, Jean-Luc Godard died this week, film director, and he had an assisted death because he was living in Switzerland. And that, again, obviously has brought up questions about whether that's that should be allowed. And I'm like, yes, please, because I don't want, you know what I mean? There are certain things that might happen that I don't particularly want to live through. Thanks very much. So, yeah, I think it's interesting. I also read so obviously loads of states people are going to descend on London weekend for the funeral, and that the Japanese emperor and empress are coming to the funeral, which is unusual because they consider death to be unclean.
Okay, I didn't know that.
Apparently they don't attend funerals as a general rule. So I was like,
that's interesting.
Yeah, I wanted to know more about it. It was it was said as a cultural thing.
Yeah, I'm quite interested in the ritual around. I mean, I'm interested in ritual anyway, in lots of different contexts. I think ritual's a really important part of human life and society. It's how I think we start to process things, and obviously this is ritual to the millionth degree, you know, everything that's happened around the Queen. And despite being, I mean, apathetic at best about the monarchy, I mean, on my good days, I'm apathetic. I have found it all oddly fascinating. And, you know, this sort of the collective grief, I mean, some of it has been mad as hell, obviously. But I do find that interesting. I mean, what is it about certain people, whether they be celebrities or royalty or what have you, where somehow I think there's a huge amount of transference going on. I think there'll be a lot of people, and I'm not ashamed to say I probably found myself doing this a little bit, of who people who attach their grief or feelings of grief for someone else onto someone very visible. And I found myself thinking a lot about my mum. I don't subscribe to all. She was the nation's granny. I don't subscribe to that view at all. But there was something about, you know, my mum was a massive royalist. She loved the Queen. The day Diana died, honestly, I mean, she was practically in mourning herself. It was absolute madness that day. You know, my mum would have been, had she been fit and well and healthy, my mum absolutely would have been in that 8-hour queue waiting to go and see her lying in state, which is not something I don't understand that. I wouldn't do it, frankly. But I have found myself thinking a lot about her this week, and what, you know, she would make of it and what she would think and how she would feel about Charles and all that sort of stuff. So I think there is something really interesting in how society deals with these sorts of these rituals and celebrations and ceremonies and all the different signifiers. You know, it's odd. It's been a very odd week. This is quite interesting, but also quite odd.
Oh yeah, I think it's all absolutely bonkers. But Have I been transfixed to the new?
Yeah.
Yes, I have. Partly because, well, so I think I've talked about this before, but one of the things I'm writing about is Brexit, and in the context of the literature produced since, but I'm also interested in why it happened, particularly from a working class perspective. But watching what's been going on this week, I'm just like, well, this is part of it, isn't it? This sort of like this enthrall to monarchy, and I'm like, Republic anytime soon.
Yeah, but also I almost find as interesting are the people who are so vociferously online talking about how much they don't care about it. And I see this with royal wedding, you know, anything vaguely, you know, there are definitely people on my Twitter and on my Instagram who have done nothing but post about how ridiculous it all is all week. And it's just like, well, stop, you're feeding into it. And there are other issues to talk about. There's Ukraine, there's Chris Carver, there's all this other stuff that's going on in the world, absolutely needs to be talked about, the energy crisis, for Christ's sake. But all those people, there are that group of people who are so busy going on about how we're not talking about those things that they are also not talking about those things. They're just talking about how we're not talking about those things. You know what I mean? Like, you're almost as obsessed as the people that are sitting in the 8-hour queue to go and see the Queen in her coffin. Do you know what I mean? Like, if there's something else you want to talk about it. Don't talk about not talking about it. Do you know what I mean?
I deactivated my Twitter account the day after she died for a reason. And this is it. I'm just doing my continuous media watch in quiet in my flat. Just
well, exactly. And that's what I've been doing. Just quietly had a little iPad to the side going, oh, where is she now? I'm unashamed. I found the whole thing utterly fascinating. What have you been reading, Naomi?
Funnily enough, the other thing that people have been talking about this week or getting very het up about when people have mentioned it is colonialism. And I've been reading Sitsi Dangaremba's memoir, essay collection, it's a bit of both, Black and Female, which has just been published by Faber. And is, yeah, it's got three interlinked essays in it. And it starts off with this kind of like a framing introduction that talks about the history of Zimbabwe, which is where she lives. She was born into what was then Rhodesia. And she talks about, so she contextualizes it to start with, and then what she talks about is her becoming a writer. So she actually started writing when she was living in England. So her parents, because of colonialism, came to London to continue their educations because they were offered that opportunity. Her and her brother were then fostered by a white family in Brighton. They didn't know they were going to be left. They were just left and their parents disappeared. And so they spent time with them, and that was the first time she sort of realised that she was black, because somebody called her a racist name. They went back to Zimbabwe, and then when she got back to Zimbabwe, she was also isolated because the other kids then saw her as European. She'd spent time in England and she spoke English, but she started writing during that period, and that's kind of what sustained her. She started to be able to create her own world. So she writes about that. She writes about being a black female filmmaker and where all the kind of barriers are in that, and how it's not just structurally, it's not just the white men, it's also, you know, other people in her own communities that are saying that, you know, women shouldn't be doing this or elevating people for reasons that are not to do with their quality of their work. And then she talks about colonialism and that colonial mindset within communities in Zimbabwe. So this is something that I've been thinking about this week, I think, that I just alluded to, in terms of people who are being very deferential about the monarchy this week. Not that I'm saying that mourning's a bad thing, but there has been like people getting arrested for protesting. Yes. I'm just like, oh, please. But that internalization of this is what we are as a country. And she talks about colonialism being internalized by Black people in Zimbabwe and what damage that's doing to what's a fairly new country, and how they get beyond that and beyond the corruption that's taking place. It's really short. It's 180 pages, but it is absolutely packed and it is fascinating. I learned loads because I knew very little about Zimbabwe as a country. There's also a really, I'm not going to tell it. You'll have to get the book and read it. But fascinating story. So I knew that when this mournable body was shortlisted for the Booker, it had had quite a difficult journey. So nobody wanted to publish it. LP Wakatama took it on pro bono. It was then sold to Grey Wolf Press in America, and Faber bought it in the UK and then published, republished Sitsi's backlist. Sorry, I'm calling her Sitsi. I'm like, how rude of me, because I met her and interviewed her the other week. So first name terms now. So that you know, it was a push to get that published, but she tells the story of how Nervous Conditions eventually got published, and that is worse. More difficult journey, obviously, because nobody knew who she was, and she became the first black female Zimbabwean to be published in English. And then obviously Nervous Conditions went on to be one of the BBC books that changed the world. Yeah, so it's just really fascinating to see those barriers return and return. Yeah, but I thought it's really interesting, and I think she's really interesting woman and a brilliant writer. There are so many lines that I underlined in it. So
I really want to read that. I have only read this Mournable Body, the one that was shortlisted for the Booker, and I have to say I wasn't aware of her before she was shortlisted for the Booker. But I have got Nervous Conditions. I haven't read it yet, I confess. But I thought this Mournable Body was an absolutely outstanding book. I was Team Shuggy for the book for that year for reasons that I've expounded on in previous episodes at length. But this Mournable Body, I thought, was an absolutely brilliant book. And just from the publishing nerdery, I'm really interested to hear about her route to publication, because I had sort of read in other places that it, you know, that it had been quite a difficult route. So yeah, just from a kind of insider geekery, I want all the inside.
There's some really interesting stuff about her attempts to be published. I have to say as well that I started the event by saying apologies to Shuggy fans, but she was robbed.
That's fine.
I stand by it.
That's fine.
She did tell me that Douglas Stewart's a very nice man. So there we are.
I have heard that from several people who have met him from my publishing inside life, which pleases me, because it would break my heart if he wasn't.
There we go.
Good.
Books then.
Right. It's sort of sublime and ridiculous in terms of the size of the book this week, isn't it?
If we hadn't already gone off on a tangent, I would say we should have like a conversation about big books and little books, but I think we'd spent too much time yabbering about monarchy. I don't know.
Well, I think without getting too far ahead of us this series, I think we might well have certainly at least one other occasion to talk about the length of books, because later in the series we do have another absolute doorstopper coming. So I think, and actually that's something I've been thinking about generally. I do feel like there's a lot of big books around at the moment.
There are a lot of big books. It does mean though that I get to go, I like big books and I cannot lie, even though that's not true. I don't really. But it just amuses me to say it. So
It's funny. We stand by it.
I like some big books. I'm good. True. That's my nuanced take on all this. Big books or little books, it depends what the book's like. Some big books are worth it, some aren't.
The controversy we get on this podcast. My daughter went through a phase a couple of years ago being absolutely obsessed with the Sir Mix-a-Lot song. And there's just nothing like a child wandering around the house singing, "I like big butts and I cannot lie." I'll leave that image with you. Right, so big book, Tomb of Sand by Chetanjali Shri, translated by Daisy Rockwell, published by Tilted Access, which very recently won the International Man Booker. Well, not but man anymore, International Booker, no men. And then at the other end of the scale, we have the really quite short Act of God by Jill. Is it Cement?
I think it's Cement.
Cement, C-I-M-E-N-T.
Yeah. Doesn't matter how you try and say it, it comes out cement, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. So, yeah. Now, I think that's published by Pushkin, because I've got a second-hand copy and it's the American edition published by Pantheon.
Yeah, it's Pushkin, yeah.
And that is a very short book. So we have, Sublime to Ridiculous. I think we start with the big boy, don't we?
It would make sense. I think there's more to talk about with the big one, but I think that's partly to do with the fact that it is also 725 pages long. And I know I picked it. I will take the hit for that.
Yeah.
I did really want to read it. And I've got to say, not to put anyone off, because there are lots of enjoyable things about this book. But if we hadn't been reading it for the podcast, I think I would have put it down and come back to it in many months' time, there are several big books scattered around my flat that I am about two-thirds of the way through. And this would I think, would have fallen victim to that.
Yeah, 100%. It would have. Well, either I would have been so scared of the size of it that it would have sat on my shelf for 3 years before I even picked it up anyway. I do think I probably would have put it down, and it's questionable as to whether I would have picked it up again at some point, even though I did like it. I think there are some really fantastic sections. Some of the writing is absolutely beautiful, but there were definitely pages where I'd get through, 10 or 20 pages and I'd go, I have absolutely no idea what just happened, where I kind of looked at the words, certainly, but I'm not sure that they lodged in my head, which I'm not, not necessarily a fault of the book. Maybe I am just the wrong reader for it, but I did find it quite difficult at times, I have to confess.
I think it meanders quite a lot, which I think is very much there's a certain type of book in there that works really well for. And actually, some of the bits where it meandered were some of my favourite bits.
Mm.
But it's that if you want something to read where you are being driven by a plot, this is not the one. Because, I mean, it takes 150 pages for Ma, who's the main character, to get out of bed. She's taken to her bed and she doesn't get up. And then when she does get up, she turns into a wishing tree. And then she disappears and nobody knows where she's gone. And she comes back and still nobody knows where she's been for 13 days. So in terms of the plot, even though it's 725 pages, you could probably write the plot in five bullet points if you wanted to.
Yeah, absolutely. And I am unashamedly I like a narrative arc. And this is not without a narrative arc. What I liked about this book actually is sort of the bigger picture of it and the kind of the themes that which we'll talk about in more length in a minute, but the themes and ideas that it brought up I really liked and I found really interesting, but I felt that there was I got sort of too distracted in a way by the pages of me going, I don't know what's happening, to be able to, I couldn't see the wood for the trees at certain points, which is, again, not to put people off, because, well, clearly, A, it's just won the International Booker, so there are plenty of people think it's very good indeed, thank you very much. But also, I think it's just the style of writing, and people will absolutely love that and get, be able to kind of immerse themselves in this sort of slightly, as you say, meandering, hypnotic, kind of lose themselves in this kind of whirlpool of this, tome of a novel. And I just, my brain doesn't work that way. And so I found it quite difficult to kind of fully get absorbed in it.
Yeah, I didn't get fully absorbed in it. But I think one of the things I did to mitigate what you're talking about is what I used to tell the kids to do when I was teaching them Shakespeare, is that sometimes you just have to get through a passage and come back to it when you've read, You need, I it's one of those, I don't want to reread it. I'm not that fussed about rereading it, but were I to go back, I think I'd probably get something out of it.
Yeah.
More out of it again, and then possibly again. So Shakespeare perhaps is quite a good comparison in that sense, that you could keep mining it, and you'd find new things in it each time. Because there were things like, as I was making notes about what I wanted to talk about tonight, I wrote butterflies down, and it wasn't until I got to the very end that I thought about how often butterflies reoccur as a symbol in it, and they're all the way through, but it didn't even, you know, until I started to think about it as a whole, it didn't occur to me that they were there and why they were there. So yeah, I'm sure there's loads of stuff in it that I haven't picked up on.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think just because it's, you know, 725 pages, I think it's very hard to absorb any novel of that length in one go. Like, there's going to be stuff you miss, which I think, and this can be a wider discussion another time when I haven't meandered off about, you know, dead bodies and gardening. But, you know, that's the risk you take, I think, with a very long novel, unless it's a very obviously just a plot vehicle, you know, very commercial, which is not a criticism, but very kind of straightforward novel where it is just a story that you get absorbed in. I think it is a risk to take to write, you know, at that pitch for 725 pages, because I mean, as I just said, I definitely missed stuff. I definitely, like, pages went by where I was looking at the words and not reading them, which may be my own fault, you know, rather than the fault of the novel, but that was my experience reading it.
Before we get into, like, sorry, I just cut you off there, but just before we get into, like, talk about something that actually happens in the book, I'm just wondering if we mentioned enough times that it's 725 pages and whether that means someone's going to send us a certificate for reading it.
Actually, it's more than 725. I'm just checking my copy. It is, I think, in fact, it's actually 735.
Oh, there we go. So if anybody wants to send us a certificate for having completed it. It just got to a point when I realised how many times we'd said it, and I'm like, someone's going to pick us up on that. So I want
a medal, frankly, at this point.
I'll send you one on WhatsApp later.
Thanks very much. I will print it out.
Okay.
I tell you what I did, just before we start talking about the specifics of the book, tell you what I think I really wanted was an audiobook. I think if they, because I did find myself actually a few times, I was reading it out loud to try and get myself to, like, lock into it. And although I wasn't particularly successful, so many times I kept thinking, oh, I wish I could listen to this, because I feel like I would get into it more if I could hear the kind of rhythms and the, in a way that I just wasn't managing to achieve myself. And I did look, actually, and I couldn't, unless I'm being particularly dense, which is not without precedent, I couldn't actually find an audiobook version available. So whoever holds the audio rights, get on it, because I think I would listen to it. I think if it came up as an audiobook, I would go and listen to it rather than read it again, because I definitely missed stuff. Bring out an audiobook.
The wordplay had worked really well as well, because there's loads of wordplay in it, and it would be, like, yeah, it'd be really good read aloud.
Yeah, so that's my plea to whoever holds the audio rights to it. I mean, it's a long book. I mean, maybe someone's recording it, someone's stuck in a studio somewhere having to read all 735 pages. Like, that is a marathon audio session.
Are you allowed to record audiobooks during this period of mourning, Kirsty?
I don't know, is it disrespectful? I'm not sure.
You're not allowed to play football or cycle, so...
We certainly can't go to Centre Parks.
We're just going to digress. This is going to be too much. We're off now.
There we are.
Well, talking of old women... Look at that. That's swift.
Beautiful. Segue. Seamless. Gorgeously done.
The main character in this is a woman who I don't believe we ever learn her actual name, do we?
No, she's just Mom. She's known as various other things to other characters, but on the whole, she's Ma.
Yeah. So Ma, who's 80, and there's a wonderful line about her at the end of the second section where it just says at 80, Ma had turned selfish. And the sort of key to the whole book is that Ma's gone, fuck it. She's not looking after everyone anymore. She's had enough. Her husband's died. She's done. And to start with, she is done. She's in bed and she's like, yeah, no, not happening. You can all do what you want. Not getting involved. And then she gets out of bed. And then, like I said, she goes missing. And then she ends up living at her daughter's house. And then she decides she wants to travel because she's got something important she needs to do. That's basically the entire plot. But one of the things that I did like was the relationships that Ma has, particularly the one with her daughter is interesting because it seems to have evolved. They talk about when she was younger and she was the one that was letting her daughter sneak out and leaving the window open for her to get back in. She ends up living with her and then it becomes quite, I suppose there's a bit of role reversal. The daughter's trying to look after her and keep her safe, and that's not particularly what she wants. There's also the relationship with Sid, who comes to see her quite a lot, and Rosie, who is a Hijra, and they have a really like beautiful relationship, I think, actually. So I found her sort of interactions with people probably the most interesting and sort of fulfilling bits of the book.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you say, for the first 150 pages, she's basically a back. Like, she's lying with her back to the wall because she's taken, as you say, taken to her bed after her husband died. And even then, even when they are one-sided interactions, because there's all these ways, like different family members are trying to tempt her out of bed with various things, or let's get this person in to talk to her about that, or come in and say this to her. The way that she sort of doesn't react at all is just as sort of compelling in a way. That decision, that sort of active decision that she is not partaking in this, and actually what she's watching are these cracks in the walls and little bugs like on the wall, like disappearing into a crack in the wall. And she talks, you know, she thinks about, you know, she's very active. Her brain is still very active. It's just not active in the direction that everyone else wants it to be. Mm. And that becomes, so yes, there's the when she kind of goes off and disappears and then goes off and sort of creates this whole new life and circle for herself as the book goes on. Yes, she is going against all these expectations of what her family and society expects of her as an 80-year-old widow. But actually, she's doing that even before she gets out of bed, because she's not conforming to what they want. She is not, you know, performing the role that they expect of her. So she does that all the way through. And it sounds like she's done that, as you say, when she's talking about her daughter and letting her daughter out and all this kind of stuff. She has never conformed to expectations. But what I found really interesting is the way that her and her daughter's relationship shift, in that, you know, when the daughter's younger, and obviously the mother's younger as well, you know, there's this sort of air of collusion in a way, of the mother covering for the daughter and letting her out and all this sort of stuff. But then as the novel progresses, the daughter, who believes herself to be this sort of very liberal, progressive, you know, forward thinking, you know, young, not conformist person, actually she's expecting her mother to conform. You know, there's a point quite late on in the book where she says I can't bear to watch my mother's daily transformations. You know, she wants her mother to conform to this idea she has of what an 80-year-old is supposed to do, and her mother absolutely resolutely doesn't do that. I'm really interested where that shift takes place. Do you know what I mean?
I think that's partly to do with as well the fact that the daughter thinks that, because she's been married and divorced and she's got a lover that she thinks they don't know about, except her mum like becomes friendly with him once he's back in the house and stuff. And I think it's all that, because it talks about, didn't it, the first time she put a pair of Reeboks on. That's the point. Which is that odd thing, isn't it? Because it's probably one of the most conformist things you can think of as, from a Western perspective, putting a pair of, you know, whatever branded pair of trainers on. But she obviously thinks she's like cool and edgy, and I guess it's that thing of forgetting what your parents were like when they were younger. even though she's experienced it and her mum's been that sort of cool mum, if you like, it's like, no, you can't be that anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. And there was this tension I felt between what the daughter perceives herself to be and that sort of cool, you know, whatever. Whereas particularly with her mum's friendship with Rosie, she's actually doing all those things that the daughter sort of believes in the politics of. Does that make sense? Like the daughter feels like the kind of person that go, well, of course I have lots of gay friends or hijra friends or trans friends or queer friends, you know, whatever. Whereas the mother's just quietly got this really lovely relationship with Rosie without it being a thing. It's just, do you know what I mean? It's not a political statement, her friendship, or not a purposeful one. It is by its, you know, very existence. But, you know, do you know what I mean?
And I wonder how much the daughter's objection to that, though, comes from the fact she feels that Rosie stepped into her place. That she's the one at the bedside when her mother ends up in hospital. She's the one who turns up in the morning. She's the one who creates her a new dress. So she's got something to wear that she's not having to ruck up because it doesn't fit properly anymore. So I wonder whether it was that. Because there's a really, we both said the first quote that we've both written down from the book says, all women don't forget their daughters. And I wonder if it's that sort of emphasis on that role has been taken away from her in some sense, or she feels it.
Yeah, absolutely. Which I think that's absolutely true. And I think that speaks to this inherent conservatism that sort of lies within the daughter of society, you know, fulfilling society's obligations, which is not a criticism, because I think, you know, if you see someone stepping into your place, regardless of who that person is, of course that's difficult and confronting. If you think your relationship functions in one way and it's functioning in a different way, yes, of course that's a hugely discombobulating thing. But I think it is how she processes that with Rosie as a hijra person. Do you know what I mean?
But also I feel as well in this, so my understanding of it is that hijra is a gender that encompasses quite a range of people, so it would include intersex people, and whereas Rosie's sort of very definitely drawn as a trans person, as we would understand a trans person now. Which I think is quite an important distinction to do with what happens plot wise. So spoilers, but Rosie's murdered over an argument with some tenants who were living in her flat, and that was the one point in the book where I winced a bit in terms of that sort of trans trajectory of, and it's after they've seen her at her day job where she is a male tailor, and they've put the two together, and then it's been all this, there's been all this aggression about her wanting to move back into the flat, and they feel they've been deceived, and it felt that very stereotypical route of deception, murder.
Yeah.
So at that point I questioned. Yeah, I questioned why she was in the story in terms of, was she just there as a plot device, or is it more than that? It feels a bit unfair that, but I didn't think her ending was fair.
I think
I'm trying to get to.
Yeah, no, I totally see that. Absolutely. I think the other thing that comes up a lot is borders. There's a lot of borders, a lot of doors, a lot of limits, and whether that's borders quite literally, kind of obviously India and Pakistan, you've got the kind of spectre of partition and her crossing the border quite literally at one point, you know, asking for a passport, she's gonna go to Pakistan and all this sort of stuff, but also there's a lot of just crossings of various sorts, whether that's gender, whether that is crossing invisible lines of against kind of societal expectations, or borders, even when she, you know, she turns into the magic the wishing tree. I kept saying I wanted to say magic money tree, but that's what Theresa May had. The wishing tree. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's all these. I'm so sorry to taint it with the spectre of May, but there's a line I wrote down: the limits of the imagination have yet to be discovered. If you cross one limit, another will arise. Mm. And I felt like that's a theme that came up a lot throughout the book.
There's a really brilliant section. I'm not going to read it because it's about four pages long, but there is a real... So back to what I said at the beginning, some of my favourite bits are when the narrator, although this isn't the narrator, it's the mother, she sort of takes over at this point and talks about borders, because she's sitting in this prison in Khyber where they've kept her because they've got an ancient Buddha that she has taken many, many years prior, and it's lived in their house in hiding all this time, and she wanted to take it back. And she, there's a beautiful sort of four pages about borders, and that, in fact, I am going to read a little bit of it because there's a great line in it about what borders are that I just thought, yep. Border, Mar says, border. Do you know what a border is? What is a border? It's something that surrounds an existence. It is a person's perimeter. No matter how large, no matter how small. The edge of a handkerchief, the border of a tablecloth, the embroidery around my shawl, the edges of the sky, the beds of flowers in this yard, the borders of fields, the parapet around this roof, a picture frame, everything has a border. However, a border is not created to be removed. It is meant to illuminate both sides. You removed me. Should I leave? No. A border does not enclose, it opens out, it creates a shape, it adorns an edge. This side of the edging blossoms as does that. Embroider the border with a shimmering vine. Stud it with precious stones. What is a border? It enhances a personality. It gives strength. It doesn't tear apart. A border increases recognition. Where two sides meet and both flourish, a border ornaments their meeting. And on it goes. But yes. So I thought that was a really brilliant section about borders illuminating rather than...
Completely. And I think, you know, this is one of those sections where the writing is just gorgeous. Like, you know, that's, you know, when I was reading it, there'd be those, and that was one of the sections, but these sections where you think, my God, this is extraordinary. And then it'd be sections where I was just a bit like, I don't know. I don't know what's happening.
Fair enough. Shall we segue into other impossible things that... that may or may not be happening with mushrooms. That sounded like we've been on drugs.
It's been a hell of a summer. very, very different book. Act of God by Jill Cement, with great apology if it's like, is it sort of like Simon? Is it like a French Canadian thing? Anyway, poor Jill Cement. Yes, so published in 2015, originally by Pantheon, who's the edition I've got, Pushkin Press in the UK. This is a much straightforward sort of a narrative, certainly a lot shorter, about twins, Edith and Kat, who are in their early 60s, and they live in a rent-controlled apartment, which in a bigger house owned by an actress called Vida. Who owns the rest of the house, but due to a previous thing to do with the legal stuff.
That was really succinct, Kirsty.
Like my brain just went, no.
They inherited the tenancy from their mother.
Thank you. They inherited the tenancy from their mother. And my brain did not grasp. Vida can't kick them out. They've got the apartment. And one of the twins, Edith, is a very traditional, very staid, very sensible. She works in a legal library. She has mind like a steel trap, and has been living very sensibly and frugally for all these years. Whereas Kat is much more extravagant. She goes out drinking. She's had loads of boyfriends. She's, you know, she's very flighty. She hasn't stuck to a career. But her one sort of great mission is collecting their late mother's advice, because she was an advice columnist and she desperately wants to get these advice columns published. And that's where we are at the opening of the book. So Kat is temporarily living with Edith, and they find a glowing mushroom in the apartment.
I would really enjoy that gap between glowing and mushroom. Like, what is she gonna say?
Yeah, it's these odd sort of radioactive style mushrooms that start growing in the apartment, and they are trying to get it off the wall. Edith is trying to get hold of Vida, who's only upstairs, saying, look, there's something really weird going on in our apartment. There's mushrooms, they're glowing, it's weird, there's an infestation, there's something as weird as going on. But Vida keeps ignoring the calls, she's not picking up and she's not returning anything. The mushroom spreads, the whole house has to be kicked out. At some point along the way, Vida, who's perspective we get a few times throughout the book, finds a young Russian lady living in her wardrobe and she becomes a main character as well, and it goes on from there. So yeah, mushrooms as plot device.
Yeah, I was disappointed with the mushrooms. I picked this because I thought it was going to be fucking weird. And I was disappointed. I wanted more weird. Yeah, it was another one that, like, I liked it, but I didn't love it. And the first thing that I wrote when I finished it was, what's it really about? But then as I started thinking about it, I picked out some things that it might be about. But it's not about mushrooms.
No, the mushrooms, and actually compared to the blurb of the book, which I don't have in front of me because my I've got a hardback, actually, a secondhand hardback, and the dust jacket has disappeared.
I'll read it.
Oh, thank you.
64-year-old twins Edith and Kat are starting to panic. An iridescent mushroom has appeared in the closet of their rent-controlled Brooklyn apartment. Upstairs, their wealthy landlady is ignoring their phone calls, but when she discovers a Russian au pair living in her guest room closet, she is horrified to spot the same phosphorescent glow. As the toxic mold spreads, the four hapless women are evacuated from their contaminated homes without any possessions to join the thousands of people made vagrants in their own city. Filled with darkness and comic suspense, Act of God is a very funny, poignant story about the human instincts for love, forgiveness, and a place to call home in this lively, inhospitable world.
Yeah, so from that, I was expecting more mushroom. Or certainly more, you know, when it says, you know, there were thousands of people displaced, actually it feels a lot more contained than that when you read the book. Yes, there are blocks. It feels like a few blocks are contaminated, but actually the wider city and the wider country, even it's contained even within Brooklyn, as far as I can tell. It's not even spread to the rest of the state, let alone the country. So it feels, I suppose I was expecting something slightly more apocalyptic.
I wonder if it's partly because we're like living through the end of a pandemic. Because there were points where they were like literally in the hazmat suits and they were having to be sprayed down, and it felt very much like the early days of 2020 when we were watching that on the telly. Yeah, I suppose it's that, isn't it? It's partly, oh, we've lived through it. This is not dramatic.
As that, or there was something tonally similar to it for me, to Station 11. Although I think Station 11's a much better book, sorry. But there was something in that unexpected contagion. But something, there is a kind of wry humour to it that I think was quite similar to the sort of wry humour that you find in Station 11. But of course, in Station 11, it is a sort of massive influenza pandemic where whole populations are wiped out kind of thing. But in a way, and this is probably on me again, it's sort of my expectations were something really cataclysmic. And of course, it is cataclysmic for those characters. You know, just because it didn't happen to vast swathes of the population, of course, these characters do lose everything. The house is essentially dissolved, sort of bathed in acid. So, yes, actually, that's quite an interesting interesting point. Something that is cataclysmic for one person might not be widespread, but maybe that's a fault in the copy. I don't know. Yeah.
And it felt more, so when I went back to that, what's it really about? For me, it felt more like it was a comment on American society.
Mm.
And on multiple aspects of society. So Edith, we learn very, so big spoiler, if you're going to read it, fast forward this next bit. Edith dies very quickly in terms of like how far through the book we are. So that's sort of the, after the mushroom, that's sort of the first big turn, and she is partly a death accelerated by the mushrooms, though we don't know that until later on. And the thing that is uncovered from that is that Edith's been in this long-term relationship with the lawyer who she works for's wife for many, many, many years, and has kept it quiet all this time. And I think that one of the things so that I'd sort of then thought and started to think, was it about, was about things that we kept hidden. Why did she keep that hidden from everybody? Well, society, a sister. I mean, she didn't even tell her sister that she was in a relationship with another woman. Then we've got Ashley, who is an au pair who's been kicked out of her job. So by this point, she's in the country illegally. She's literally living in Vida's closet. Vida doesn't know she's there. She gets seen when she brings in security cameras because she thinks it's Frank who looks after the building, who's going through her underwear. Which I thought was a nice twist to find out that, you know, it wasn't a Me Too situation.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. And I mean, Vida's an actress as well. So she's hiding. I mean, I don't think we find out. This might prove my ignorance as a reader. But it got towards the end and she went home for a bit. And her home country is not what I was expecting. And then I'm like, oh, I've been reading about a person of colour all this time, and I don't think it was ever mentioned.
Now, I think I had clocked something early which suggested to me that Vida was a person of colour that was then confirmed towards the end. I hadn't thought massively about it, to be honest. Mm. I mean, I suppose, why does she need to tell us? But
well, but it's that thing, isn't it, about the assumptions that you then make, which is a fault on my part, and also like more generally in terms of what's published. But again, it felt, I don't know, I wondered whether she was leaning into the whole things being hidden or not shown, or people covering up aspects of themselves. Because she's very good. One of the things that it comes out about Vida, and there's the ending, the very last couple of paragraphs are superb on this. And the way that she can literally suck up other people. I mean, not literally, sorry. But she observes other people in very dire situations and then can recreate that in her look and demeanour perfectly. So I'll not spoil it, but one of the characters has a stroke and she draws on that right at the very end. And there's this sort of sense of a leeching, which is what she's doing with when she takes over the building. I mean, she ignores Edith and Edith dies because of her ignorance. So, I wondered how much the writer was talking about that idea. So it's meant to be the American dream, and in some sense, they're all there wanting these things for themselves, except possibly Edith, who is just seems to be content as she is. She's not there long enough for us to find out. But if it's back to that sense of a scarcity of things, and so they're all taking from each other because there's that sense that there isn't enough to go around.
Yeah, and I think with Vida particularly, there's this sense of desperation where she's constantly scrabbling, you know, she's constantly, whether that's as an actress, which is obviously a notoriously insecure profession where you are competing for roles and scrabbling for what parts you can get. But later in the book, once it becomes public knowledge that the fungus, the iridescent mushrooms, originate in her house, she becomes known in the press as Mushroom Mary. She's quite funny. And obviously she loses any acting work. She ends up working as a receptionist in a gym, basically. And there's this sort of shame of how she's ended up, that she hasn't sort of achieved this great stardom that she wanted to, or the stardom that she's got is not the one she wanted, more to the point, this notoriety, which is what forces her to start, you know, again, sort of leeching, as you say, like trying to scrabble for the next thing. She's trying to get out of a legal situation as well, which I won't go into for spoiler reasons. And it's this, again, that goes back to the sort of idea of American society, is like, you're on your own. Your house gets dissolved in acid. Well, tough, you're just gonna have to find someone. You know, there's no assistance there. There's no, the American dream ultimately gets embodied as like, you're just going to have to try and get a leg up on the next guy kind of thing. But of course, there's, you know, the four characters who we see from, you know, their perspectives as narrators and parts of the book. You've got Kat and Edith, you've got Vida, and you've got Ashley, the au pair, and all of them are trying to find stability, I think. Whether that's Edith, and Edith seems to have it more than anyone, but of course she may have the kind of home stability of, you know, her rent controlled apartment and her very frugal living, and she's very sensible and legal, set, you know, legal librarian and all this, but actually you find out, because she's in this relationship that is by society standards quite shocking, she's having this long time affair with another woman who's married to the lawyer. You know, she doesn't have that stability of the open, obvious relationship, whereas Kat has a much more unstable day-to-day existence. But towards the end of the novel, again, this isn't a massive spoiler, but she begins to settle down after Edith's death. I think in part because she has found out that Edith isn't as sort of stayed as she thinks she was. Do you know what I mean? And that somehow to me seems to trigger, along with some other plot stuff that I won't go into, this kind of, she realizes the importance of community and stability, and she starts to build this community around her from some of the displaced people as a result of the mad mushrooms.
Yeah, and it seemed to me that was the sort of point of it, really, I guess, that community was important, that the and she almost tries to rescue everybody that comes out of that street, who've got, you know, nowhere else to go, or have, you know, been told there's going to be weeks and weeks to wait for any sort of insurance payout or whatever. Yeah. And yeah, she sort of almost turns into a bit of a mother hen.
It's that idea of found family, isn't it? Again, you know, yeah. She doesn't have her biological family anymore. Her last link to that and has gone, and the link to her mother's advice columns is gone, because the papers were largely destroyed in the house. So she has to rebuild from the ground up.
Yeah, I think it was the having to let go of this idea. So because she wants to publish them as a book, and she has to let go of that idea that she's going to preserve him. That it's almost, isn't it, that sense that, and I suppose, again, it got me thinking about what we've been living through last couple of years, is that there is no stability, there is no preserve. Well, there is to a sense, but, you know, lots of things won't be preserved, and that's just how it is. So, it's really difficult. Well, anxiety driven to live like that. And I think some of that, I'm going to go off on one now, but I think some of that is being deliberately caused by political decisions. However, you have to find something that then within that that keeps you sane, and her answer to that is to form a community, which would be my answer to it as well. So there we are.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, actually, thinking about it, a lot of this is about letting go as well, isn't it? you know, all of the characters have to let go of big things, whether that's their place in America, whether that's, you know, their lifestyle, whether that's their livelihood, whether that, you know, they've all had to let go, and the past, obviously, the classic thing to let go of. That's a big recurring theme.
Yeah, I thought you referred to Tuma San then, which I would say again is that they all have to let go of things too.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of letting go, but also, I mean, the other thing, obviously, this has in common with Tomb of Sand is we have older female protagonists, hurrah, more of those, acting in ways that society doesn't expect.
More of that.
More of that.
That's the way that I'm going.
Yeah, me too.
Sod it all.
Absolutely. Let's build a community.
We have got a community. We've got a community of two and our listeners.
Yes. What a lovely gang we are.
We are. We're excellent. What are we treating them to next week, Kirsty?
Oh, we've got something quite different. We're in the Victorian times, which is lovely. I like to, like where I like to spend my time. We've got a fiction and a non-fiction. So we are reading Out of the Shadows, Six Visionary Victorian Women in Search of a Public Voice by Emily Madorakawa, and then a novel called The Fair Fight by Anna Freeman. Anything that comes with a Sarah Waters quote is fine by me. And the other one is about mediums and talking to ghosts. So frankly, I am in hog heaven.
You know, if we don't love them both now, there's going to be trouble, isn't there?
Well, I just won't accept it.
Okay. So next week's episode is going to be about how great these two books are. Don't expect any critical faculties here.
No.
Excellent. It's good to be back anyway. In the meantime, you can subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts. And we are both on Twitter. Kirsty is at The Other Kirsty and I am at Naomi Frisbee. So if you wish, you can follow us there and find out what we're up to. I've got loads of events coming up in the next 2 weeks, as in the 2 weeks after... the 2 weeks following this podcast coming out, so you can find out where I'm chairing and come and listen to some of the events, because I'm chairing some excellent authors. I've just bigged up myself without talking about who I'm interviewing, but I'm interviewing one of Kirsty's authors, so you know.
We are working together. Yes, Naomi is chairing an event with an author that I am working with, which will be very good fun.
I'm looking forward to it. So, yes, so you can follow us on Twitter, find out all about that, and we will see you next week. Thank you for listening.
Thank you.